Today's program is brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit christmastreesny.org.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45 or 1 o'clock on the Heritage Radio Network. Joined, as usual, with Nastasia of the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
Got Dave in the booth.
What up?
And we brought everybody's favorite person to beat on, Peter Kim.
Once again here to spread hate and vacate.
The director slash client of and short order cook, as it turns out, for the Museum of Food and Drink.
Sometimes too.
Nice. Oh, you guys in your freaking dishwasher. Oh my God. So, like, these guys, Nastasia, right or wrong, they're like, they live in that old school office world. It's like literally 10 people working in this big kind of like law space.
In one space.
And they still...
No walls.
Giant space. And they still have the same like weird office arguments. Like, so you think...
Over email. We're copied on them.
Someone didn't put away their sauerkraut. It's like, you think you're trying to get away from like offices to get away from that. I've noticed the spoons are stacking up. And I'm like copied on these emails. And I'm like...
Well, here's the funny thing, Dave. You don't read any emails that come in, including ones that are pertinent to your business interests.
That's because whenever
and
I...
yet you respond to the, what you call, inane dish emails. And you just send me these little needling messages being like... kill me, period.
That's the reason, folks, that I don't respond to email. If I only got 3 emails a day and they were important, then I would respond to them. But whenever I glance, every once in a while, I never answer emails. Whenever I glance at my emails, it's something incredibly worthless. Incredibly worthless. I'm terrible in meetings, people. I used to have this tactic in meetings where, remember this is the French culinary, Nastasia? Meetings, like, people would start just saying inane things, just crazy, and like wasting time, and I would just start going, and you would just start like tapping your hands on the table, and they were like, "What is he doing?" He's like, "This is what you are doing to me. You're hurling our time into the ether." I'm a firm believer, people, in never responding to emails. Now, I might take it too far, but I think everyone responds to emails too often. There's a mental cost to switching back and forth between tasks all the time. Maybe this is why people don't ever get anything done.
Well, there's something called teamwork, Dave, that requires something called communication. And it either has to happen by phone, email, or in person.
So you're saying...
It's two different schools of thought.
You're saying, wait. So what Peter is saying is that nothing ever got done before the age of email because there was no team building back before they had email conversations. Where you say, you know what? Like... You don't really need to meet every 30 seconds, which is what email is. An email is a meeting every 30 seconds, right? It's totally inefficient because you're like, oh my God, what do they say? Do I have to get angry? How many people do I have to CC? And then you have to craft a response. And then they have a response to the response, and so on and so on. This is how Hillary got her classified email issues, by the way. It's like 18 levels of response. I don't care. It's the truth. Like, these are like long email chains. And like, what's the point? Like, what's the point? Just be, especially... People, they all work in the same box. Walk over.
Emails, there's a reason for emails.
But these
ones are crazy.
Literally, I can reach over, should I choose to, which you know I never would, I can reach over and touch Nastasia on the shoulder. However, at MoFad, they would send an email from me to Nastasia. That's how it would freaking work. Literally, I could be staring you in the eyes and be sending you an email.
Maybe they want to have it on record.
Wow, so much hate and...
So it never happens again. The sauerkraut, the spoons, all that.
I told you.
Dude, I've never worked in an office where you don't have some of that sort of day-to-day crap. I mean, you just have to.
You don't, actually.
Yeah, you do.
You actually do not. You could choose to say, you know what, people? I am looking at my email 4 times a day. And that's it. 4 times a day. Realize that after I respond to you, I'm not going to see it for another quarter of a day.
That probably wouldn't cut down on the flow of useless email, though.
Yeah.
Well, it would cut down on not the external useless emails, but once people weren't in the position where they felt like they were going to get a response within 10 seconds, that it wasn't going to be like, bing-a-ding, and you're like, oh, yeah, oh, wait, oh, oh.
You're changing hearts and minds.
Here's the other thing, dude. Have you ever, like, this is especially true in kitchen. In offices where, I'm not saying that offices are bad, but in offices where, like, productivity is punished and it's more about, like, the amount of emails you send that determine whether you're a good human being or not. In kitchens, this becomes a nightmare because you can't actually sit and have a real conversation with someone because they're constantly being interrupted by texts from other venues. No one can actually – there's a huge chunk of people that just can't get anything done because they can't focus for 30 seconds to a minute and a half on the actual important crap that's being told to them live and instead are focused on freaking text. Nastassja, you've seen this a million times, right? Especially once people are bored at work. Like once you get people who are bored at work, then all they do is focus on their texts. That's it.
Yeah, so in your mind, there was a golden age when things got done that stopped around the 90s?
No. I'm saying, like, all these tools are great. It's just they're being used by people, like, in a knucklehead way. I'm saying all these tools are useful. I'm just advocating, like I say, not being constantly plugged into something that can pull your attention. Maybe you have a job out there, people, that doesn't require you to think. But if you have to think, then being pulled from conversation to conversation every 20 seconds is not helpful. It's just not freaking helpful. It's like with cooking. It's like when you're cooking in a kitchen, my wife always says, why is it, you know, what is it that's like, what is it about the kitchen that, you know, you think is hard for people to get? It's hard for people to stay in the flow of the kitchen because they get bored and they get sucked out into other things. And then they lose track of what they're doing, their mental flow of what they're doing in the kitchen. And so, yeah, they burn the sauce. They don't take the thing out of the freaking oven. They don't have the timings work out right when the stuff comes out of the oven. Because they're a bad cook? Well, maybe. But maybe part of the reason they're a bad cook is that they're not focusing on the flow of what happens in the kitchen. Good kitchen work is supposed to have a little bit of that in the flow, zen, like I'm working and this is what I'm doing. I'm not doing some other garbage, right? I'm doing this. No?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, anyway, whatever. I had to relate it back to the cooking. So, Peter, why are you here to harangue me about something?
And mission accomplished, I think.
Yeah?
Yeah.
No, you were going to harangue me about something.
Hey, well, yes. It's going to keep coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not promoting anything?
What?
No, not promoting anything.
Just here to needle you, man.
All right. Yeah. Well, like, so now I'm owed some needling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I just got back, not really, I got back at the end of last week, but I haven't done the show since, from Chef Steps. First time I visited Chef Steps in Seattle. Went to Jamie Boudreaux's bar, Cannon. Very, very nice. Nice place. I think they might have just won some award or something. I don't know. Great bar. The most ridiculous liquor list I have ever seen in my life. Like the crazy, like they can't print the liquor list because it'd be like a phone book, so it comes out in like iPad form. To give you an example, I don't really understand this, but they have a whole bunch of like super, super old whiskeys, like super old, like from like the 1800s that are like $1,400 a shot. I asked the waiter, I was like, is that very good, that whiskey? He was like, no. He's like, but when someone like Microsoft or some like, you know, tech dude shows up there and makes a giant deal, he's like, what do you got that's really expensive? And then once you spend $1,400 each, this guy bought $2,800 worth of whiskey, two shots, $2,800 worth of whiskey.
Jeez.
You're going to love that crap. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the advantage of charging so much for something. The customer's inherently going to like it.
It's
because
too much cognitive dissonance if you feel like, oh, that was not really exciting.
Right. You would have to be so rich. Like, yeah. you would have to be billionaire rich to be able to be like, you know what? I can be entirely objective about this $1,400 ounce and a half pour of liquor that I just drank. Yeah, they have – so –
Is that the place that has a giant wall of bottles? Is that it?
I wasn't facing a giant wall of bottles. And I didn't look around because that's the kind of guy I am. They have really tall ceilings. I'm that guy that like walks in, sits down, and just stares down at his napkin.
You couldn't miss this. It was, I'm thinking of a different
right,
place.
Right, Nastassja?
So annoying. Were you by yourself?
I was not by myself. I was with the Chef Steps crew.
Mm.
Yeah. And he's part of the Chef Steps crew, your boy Michael Napkin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so I said, Nastassja still loves you. Yeah, the only vegetarian Nastassja likes. I said you're still enjoying his cookbook. I said, you know, maybe he should write another vegetarian cookbook. Yeah, right? Anyway.
Well, the only vegetarian Nastassja likes is not really that much of a distinction because there's how many people that she likes.
Yeah, but if there's five people that she likes and only one of them is vegetarian, well, I guess you're right. Like on a percentage basis.
It's not really
basis.
Much of a, yeah.
All right, fair. fair. So anyway, I went out to Chef Steps and demonstrated the spins all. They seemed to enjoy it. Did a Facebook Live, which I still don't really understand.
I don't either.
I don't really understand this Facebook Live.
I think it's very new. Right, yeah? Peter?
It's not that new. It's like 6 months ago.
Yeah, it's very new. Yeah.
Why would I want that?
Because people can text in as you're doing it.
Actually, that's true. People ask questions. Yeah. It is useful. It's kind of like this, but with people. I'm just joking, people. I'm just kidding with you guys. So,
We did a Facebook Live about the sort of dish situation that Moaf had the other day.
Did you?
Really? Yeah, yeah,
did
yeah.
All five of you chimed in?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So, anyway, so I, during that, like, one, and I visited Kenji. Over in San Francisco, saw his digs, did the centrifuge demonstration for him. Here's what, by the way, we're talking about the Spinzall, which is a new centrifuge I'm selling on modernistpantry.com/. I'm not supposed to say forward slash, sorry.
It's just slash.
It's just slash. It's freaking forward slash. Back when I was a kid, when I was a boy, we had backslashes. We had forward slashes. Now it's just slash. So modernistpantry.com/Spinzall. We got to sell more of these freaking centrifuges, people. I think there's a lot of people out there don't know why they would, I mean, not you people, if you're listening to this, right? I mean, you know why you want a centrifuge. But I think a lot of people just don't get why they would want a centrifuge. They only think of these modernist kind of techniques. And I'm like, just like being able to make strawberry juice all day, all night is like enough for me, or banana justino, or any one
Would you get one, Peter?
Yeah. It's like exponentially cheaper than any other alternative or something like that.
Hey, Dave, right. We actually got a question about the Spinzall in the chat room.
Oh, what do you got?
They want to know what would happen if you put molasses in it.
Molasses is pretty much a solution, so I don't think it would do much to it. So that's another thing is like most people, what I realize is that I've used a centrifuge for so many freaking years that like I kind of know what a centrifuge is going to do and what it's not going to do. But when Kenji said, what should I spin in this? And there was a bunch of responses to him about what we should try to spin in the centrifuge. I kind of realized that people don't really understand what a centrifuge at this kind of, level is for. Like, for instance, it's not for clearing meat stocks, although I'm trying to think of a way to do it. It's not for that. It's, you know, if you take milk, if you take milk with cream, yeah, I can, you know, unhomogenized, I can separate it out. But, and if you take cream, I can make butter. But like molasses, like I say, is a solution. There might be some crap floating in the molasses that I can get out, but I'll give you some examples of stuff to do, with some sugar stuff. So I did someone wanted me to do chocolate milk, and I'm like, I don't think I'm going to get a lot out of that. So I did chocolate cream. I made like a cocoa cream and then with some sugar in it, and then I spun it hoping to get cocoa butter. Not cocoa butter, but chocolate butter, you know what I mean? And what happened was I got an amazing – I got a triple separation. So I got like a chocolate buttermilk, which I used to make pancakes. It was very good. Then I got a very light chocolate butter because basically the only chocolate that was in it was in the whey that was in it. And then I got a hyper smooth kind of like cocoa paste, like Nutella, but totally smooth and liquid, which was pretty awesome as well because it had been totally hydrated. And I ended up mixing those back together to make like a chocolate butter, but like a chocolate compound butter. It was really good. So you can do that kind of stuff, or like Greek yogurt. Like I could take yogurt, I can remove some of the whey, then you do that, you know. And you get like you can either do Greek yogurt or like a yogurt cheese, which I made. So it does that on that kind of dairy, but it's for like clarifying juices, but it's not for like breaking stocks. It's not going to take things that don't ever naturally settle or break on their own and make them break. You know, it will spin blood down. I'm told it will spin blood down because it's at the same speed. I got a lot of people asking me about that, I guess, to fortify blood sausages or whatever, and that will work. But anyway.
Here's a question for you, man. When was the last time there was a sort of previously inaccessible technology because of the price point that, like, seriously dropped like this?
The circulator went from about $2,000. The immersion circulator went from about $2,000 in 2002 to about $800 in 2005, mostly as a result, Philip Preston just wanted more chefs to have them, and so the price got
drop, because when only labs were buying it, labs are a relatively inelastic market. They're just going to pay whatever you ask. And so when the chef market kind of got big, you know, Philip knew the price needed to drop. So that was kind of the first big price drop. $800 is still relatively expensive, but that was the kind of the first explosion into the market. And that's kind of, you know, I'm taking a bigger price jump there with the Spinzall. So I'm going from a $8,000 to $10,000 machine down to like a $1,000 machine. So I'm trying to hit some of those early adopters who would have gotten an immersion circulator back in the $800 days. Then Weepop, Supipot, Bam, who was one of my interns, came out with the Nomaku, and the Nomaku was, to my knowledge, the first commercially available sub-$500 circulator. And then I think it came in at like 300 and something originally. And then Philip came out with one, and then, you know, a whole host of others have really driven the circulator market way down until now it's hard to get someone to pay more than $250 for a circulator. And then you have people adding, like Chef Steps with Jewel has added the app and the Wi-Fi capability. And so that market is really expanding. I mean, that's the one. That's where a previously inaccessible thing has really gotten into kitchens. Because and the reason it doesn't happen very often is that there's not many technologies that are taken from other realms that have, like, instant and obvious kitchen applications. Like the, you know, blender was, like, they have laboratory blenders, but, like, the blender was intended to be a piece of kitchen equipment. You know, and other things are always going to be inaccessible, like puffing guns or like extruders or, you know, pasta extruders and things like this. Although pasta extruders are becoming more popular, but they're at like the $3,000 and $4,000 level. So it's there aren't going to be that many there aren't that many things that I've experimented with where I'm like, yeah, that needs to be really popular. Immersion circulator was one. So people used to say, which one of these technologies is really going to make a big deal? They asked me back in '04, and I was like, oh, the immersion circulator, clearly, you know. And it's one of the very few things I've been right about, you know, in terms of future predictions. And the other one that I've always wanted, I want a RotoVap to be more accessible to people. But the reason I'm not building a RotoVap is that although we could make a more accessible RotoVap, it still is not going to have the wide range of use for people that a centrifuge would. Just because it's always going to, no matter how cheap I make a RotoVap, no matter how breakproof I make a RotoVap, no matter how bulletproof it is, it's always going to take like a lot of skill to operate one well, and it's going to take like a fairly steep learning curve. Whereas with a centrifuge, once you learn how to use it, you're just pumping product out. And so, and also like a RotoVap, no matter what, is going to require chilling. So you're either going to have to bust through a bunch of ice, or you're going to have to bust through, buy a chiller. It needs heat, needs all this ancillary stuff, like a lot of power. And so, I always thought the centrifuge is the item that should be available in the kitchen, but what it really needed is someone to design one for the kitchen. But we're not selling enough of them, so if you actually ever want there to be a culinary centrifuge, and who knows, maybe in, 10 years if the market, or 5-6 years if the market opens up more, maybe they'll eventually be a $300 centrifuge. Who knows? You know what I mean? Or, a $200 centrifuge. But Nastassi and I simply aren't making enough of them. Well, right now we're making zero because we haven't been able to pay for the tooling or the production run. But if you don't buy it, we won't make it.
And if I may, I'll say that I have the luck/ misfortune of working with you about as much as anybody else. But I will say that, I can vouch for the fact that Dave puts a ridiculous amount of time and thought into this thing. So if there's anybody who could do it, I mean, really.
This is the only product I really like.
Yeah.
Really? That's because also you hate having to run the normal centrifuge, too. It's big.
That's true.
Yeah. I'm very thankful that this is not on the list of things Nastassi will never touch again, because the list grows every day. Not about my centrifuge, but because I'm working on this centrifuge, I'm getting a lot of tweets in about this coffee machine. Have you heard of it? Spin?
Mm-mm.
Spin? And so it's a centrifugal coffee machine. It's actually something I've been interested in. So what Spin does is they don't show you the inner workings or the guts of it. But what it is it's got a bunch of, like, application hoo-ha attached to it. You can, like, make a coffee while you're on the road so that by the time you get home it's cold and ruined, if that's what you want to do. I'm kidding. But or you can wake up and you can tell Alexa. Is it Alexa or Lexis? What's the name of that?
Alexa.
Alexa?
Yeah.
Is that a real human name, or is it named that because it's not a real human name?
I don't know.
Anyway, Alexa, brew me some coffee. And so the spin, like, will listen. The Alexa will tell the spin. I saw Kenji, by the way, turn on his immersion circulator like that.
He was through, like, Alexa.
He was like, Alexa. He doesn't talk like that. He's like, Alexa, turn on my Juul. And like, and the Juul, like, turned on and started running. He doesn't talk like that at
Wait,
all.
Wait, so it's connected to every single appliance with what, Bluetooth?
I think it can. I think Alexa's just on your network, and so it can probably do a Bluetooth-enabled device or a wired wireless device or even a wired device. I think it's just a question of – I don't know how it works, to be honest. But anyway, well, so
– hopefully there aren't that many people named Alexa.
I don't have one. Yeah. You remember The Wizard of Oz?
Hosed, yeah.
Remember The Wizard of Oz? Mm. Like when he's like taking off and like Toto jumps and she goes out to get Toto and they're like, come back. He's like, I can't. I don't know how it works. Remember that? That's like one of my favorite like Wizard of Oz lines. But I don't know where I got in that. So anyway, so people ask me about this spin. So what it does is it grinds whole beans and then presumably puts the – presumably, because I don't know, puts it into the into a basket, dry, spins it up, thereby like evening and like, you know, pseudo-tamping the coffee grounds down, and then introduces the hot liquid to the basket while it's spinning. And then because of the force – the theory is it generates the equivalent of a certain amount of pressure. So by altering the speed at which the basket rotates, it can produce something that is espresso-like or drip coffee-like. Now, a lot of people on the internet are like, that won't work. And people have asked me, do you think that will work? And the truth is, I have no way to know because I haven't tested it, right? So I will say that there is no way I believe it's going to produce something exactly like espresso, and here's why. When you were making a puck, an espresso puck, right? You're basically trying to create a hydraulic puck that compresses extremely evenly. You then saturate that puck. The puck kind of inflates, and as you force water through it, the fines migrate to the bottom, increasing theoretically, I guess, the hydraulic pressure. But at the same time, you're decreasing the amount of solids left, so your rate of water goes through faster. Anyway. It's like that. When you are spinning a basket and letting the water in at the same speed, your compacting pressure is the same as your theoretical liquid pressure walking through. Now, an espresso puck, clearly you're tamping with much less force than you are putting water through. So it's the equivalent of like maybe 20 pounds of force over the entire disc of coffee puck versus 150 psi, of the water pressure coming into it. So clearly there's a differential there that you can play with espresso that you're not going to be able to play with the spin. The other thing is, I mean, that's kind of the main thing. I mean, so it's going to be different. Also, in espresso, as soon as the pressure is released, it stops. This is actually going to pull more stuff out of the coffee grounds because of the centrifugal force than you would get if you just forced water under pressure. It's a different kind of a situation. Now, I did, just as a test, take some espresso grinds, mix them with hot water, spin them in the centrifuge for 30 seconds. I got all of the grounds back out. I tasted the coffee. It tasted fine because I wasn't pushing it through. I didn't get any aeration, and so I didn't have any of the body that you would have in a normal espresso cup. It had some of the espresso flavors that you would normally have, and it had zero grinds in it because, you know, I was able to spin it fast enough. But, I mean, the answer is I don't know. I'm willing to test out a spin machine if someone wants us to test it out, but I don't know. I mean, it could be a way to do individual servings well as opposed to, like, those cups. I've never had a cup-based machine that I thought was the greatest thing on earth. You ever had a cup?
The worst.
The worst. Not just bad, the worst. See, a lot of times, Peter, what people are focusing on when they're making those single service things is this – and this is a like not the way I focus in life, but this is a valid thing. Is this single serving better than what the average Jokomo will make given a system that they have to control? So if you're dealing with like the EC pods, for instance, the question is this EC pod – as good as the greatest espresso that you can make? No. Even the guys Ely. Ely. Is the Ely pod as good as the best espresso someone can make? No, it is not. And they will admit that. But is it better than what 90% of the people will make? Yeah. And so if you're one of those 90% of the people that's going to make a garbage espresso, then the Ely pod is a good solution for you, except for the sustainability and the fact that you're hurling all this plastic into the ether. And the spin, theoretically, if you like the coffee it made, is going from bean to cup. So it's not going to have any of those sustainability issues. The Breville, by the way, makes with the automatic grinding stuff, which I was very dubious of, does make a cup better than about 90% of people would do.
I just think there are so many easy ways to make good coffee that, okay, maybe not espresso, but like, I don't see why you'd want to use one of those machines.
I don't like the word pour over.
No.
No.
Right?
What about an AeroPress?
And say it with an Australian accent.
I can't. Can you?
No.
You hate. You have an anti-Australian accent thing, though.
Yeah.
Right? What about Olivia Newton-John's old accent?
She's okay.
Yeah.
I have to say, gooseneck things annoy me.
What?
Gooseneck? Like when someone says a gooseneck?
It just seems really precious when you're pouring the water over the pour over. I understand.
Oh.
I understand the rationale.
Why do people say precious all the time? But
shit. Well, because Peter used to work for Precious Moments.
Used to be a precious moment.
Well, that's okay.
I mean, there's the greatest moment in my life is when Peter brought a picture of himself in like a Precious Moments like furry outfit, and it was not some sort of cosplay thing. It was his parents made him dress up for the Hallmark store where they used to work. Anyway, okay. Brandon wrote in about carbonation. Hey, Bushwick crew. I'm trying to rebuild my carbonation rig with interchangeable adapters. One adapter for the liquid bread carbonator cap, which is the carbonator cap of choice, people, and one for a direct injection into an EC whipper, into the whipped cream whipper, I hope, because I don't really like the soda ones. Really just all you need is the whipped cream one. I have not had any luck getting direct injection from CO2 tank to work properly. I've tried pressing a small barbed fitting around the EC puncture valve, and some CO2 gets in, but not much. Does this EC puncture valve have to be pressed down for proper airflow? Would love any suggestions on how to get this working. Thanks, Brandon. Okay, Brandon, you're in a little bit of a pickle here. Here's why. You do not need to press on that valve to get it to work. However, when you're putting a cartridge onto that thing, what happens is the cartridge gets punctured, pushes against that rubber grommet, and is injected into the EC under high pressure. Because remember, that cartridge contains either nitrous or CO2 at a normal temperature in the atmosphere of roughly 800 PSI. So it's shooting in there, and it's shooting in a particular weight of CO2 or of nitrous, a weight, not a pressure. And so because of that, the check valve doesn't have to have a particularly low what they call cracking pressure. And so there's a good 5 PSI. I haven't measured it in many years, but it's a good 5 PSI of overpressure required to get any flow at all through that EC valve. What I used to do in the day was I would build an adapter that actually had the cheapest, easiest way to do it if you don't have access to a machine shop or anything like that, is to take your barb thing, push it against the thing gently, then screw, like put some release agent. Please put a boat ton of release agent. Like do not allow epoxy to get onto your actual EC whipper. Cut off, so I'm talking about the thing that you screw the chargers on with. Cut that off and then embed the thing, embed your barb fitting and all that into it and seal the top with epoxy. This way, when you screw it down tight, you have a fitting that can screw and unscrew onto it easily. But it's never going to be ideal because of the pressure drop you're getting across that. So if you're trying to set your tank to have the correct pressure for carbonation with a normal carbonator cap, which is a free flow situation, you're never going to get the same amount when you have to force it through a through that check valve. And that's going to become even more apparent when you're trying to shake and get that last little bit of carbonation in, because right there you're driving carbonation in under what is essentially equilibrium pressure. So it's difficult. The way that I did it when I really wanted to carbonate in EC bottles from a tank, and I did because when I opened Booker & Dax originally, that's how I thought I was going to do it. I took an old EC whipper head. You can get them on eBay real cheap that are plastic. They used to make plastic whipper heads for their non-commercial, for their home line. But the screw threads are the same. I then cut everything off of that thing that I wanted. And I bought screw-in valves. I put basically Bondo on it. Tapped it with a drill and a tap, and then I cast it in. I cast it first in silicone to make a mold, and then did a bunch of food grade polyurethane cast to make a bunch of carbonation heads that fit directly onto an EC whipper. They used EC brand gasket seals, etc., etc. And that's actually what I was going to use to open the bar with. But it takes a little bit of work. But I mean, okay, it takes a lot of work. But if you're going to do it for a living, and you really want to do it, it's worthwhile. Anyway. Did I answer that question? Or
yes.
Yes. Julian writes in about sous vide sauce. Hey, all. I'm writing to ask about making sauces with the liquid left in low-temperature sous vide bags. I'd like to use this to make a simple pan sauce just mixed with stock or red wine. But the delicious sous vide liquid quickly curdles whenever I heat it further to reduce it, leaving my reductions with weird textures. It's beyond weird. It's freaking gross. It looks like... Well, we'll get into it in a second. It is my best bet to curdle it and strain out the curds. Yes. That was easy.
But why don't you take another 10 minutes to answer the question?
Yeah, is there some way I can prevent the protein from curdling or at least get some flavor out of it? Thanks for any tips, Julian. I don't know actually that you not any tips to prevent the curdling that you would really want to do. Like you could probably very heavily salt it or very heavily sugar it. But yeah, the way to do it is to as soon as it comes out, just break it really quickly and then strain it. And like it's just protein that's in solution. And it's never been raised to a temperature that makes it curdle, and so it comes out, and that's it. You know, the same way that if you cook a fish too high, like that liquid will come to the top, and then once the heat hits it, it goes white, it turns white. It's that same sort of stuff. It's the stuff that when you start heating, floats up to the top as pond scum when you're cooking meats, and you got to get rid of it.
AKA family meal.
Yeah, family meal. Well, you know that story that Alex Guarnaschelli tells, right? Yes. Eating the raft. Ugh. I think about it. I look at it like eating the raft. So the quickest, easiest way around it is to just heat it and then strain it. And as a side note, a lot of times when you do that, the liquid will actually self-clarify because the proteins, as they coagulate, will hold on to some of the cloudy bits. Speaking of self-clarify, did I talk about self-clarifying cordials?
Yes.
Oh, all right. There you go. Don't need to talk about it again. Done. So there you have it. Now, the problem with that, of course, is you're going to lose some of the product when it curdles. There's not a lot left. So I don't know whether you want to add some product to it, then curdle it, then strain it.
We should take a break.
Take a break? Yeah. Take a break and come right back with cooking issues?
Christmas tree came from? Now you don't have to. New York State grown Christmas trees are now available in New York City. Trees grown on farms here in New York State are harvested just a few days before arrival to the city. Trees cut close to home stay fresh longer, and trees cut close to home travel less, which reduces fuel consumption of delivery vehicles. Did you know that buying a real tree helps to sustain agriculture in New York State by supporting local farmers and keeping important open space in agriculture production? The Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York is partnering with Grow NYC to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. So when you shop local this holiday season, you can include the tree in that list. For more information and a full list of locations, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
We are back. So Christmas Tree Farms, Stasia, do you know how long it takes to grow a Christmas tree?
No.
7 years.
Really?
Yeah, it's about 7 years. At least so I'm told. In Oregon, I know a guy who's a Christmas tree farmer in Oregon, and he was like, yeah, it's about 7 years for the trees to get fully mature.
I have to say, it always weirds me out to see right after Christmas how everybody just chucks their trees.
Yeah,
what are they going to do with it? First of all, I wish we had the Christmas tree farmers in New York here because you were providing jobs for someone.
Yeah, sure, I guess.
You don't mind wiping your butt with paper and flushing it down the toilet. Instead, you get enjoyment from a tree. It makes your whole house smell nice. It provides jobs. It's like a low impact farming that you can do on a chunk of land.
Did you get one?
Was it?
A tree?
No.
Did you get one from New York State?
I don't have a tree.
Why do you not have a tree?
I just don't.
I saw a hipster walking down a tree with something that looks theoretically nice but is not. Here's what they did. They had a big piece of tree that they cut a disc out of. They drilled a hole in the center. Then they took their Charlie Brown tree, right, and they shaved off the bottom of the trunk like a cork so it would fit into the hole in the tree. But this is a far cry from the old time. Old time, you had that little wooden cross. Mm-hmm. And you nailed it from underneath. Now, that's okay because you're not shaving off all of the xylem. How the hell is this little tree supposed to drink if you shave off all of its xylem.
Sad.
Sad.
So sad.
So hipster. It's such a hipster thing. I'm going to have something that looks like old school. It's more dead than dead. It's not. See, a tree is basically a cut flower. I mean, like, you know what I mean? You have to treat it like a cut flower. And would you sit there, would someone hand you cut flowers, would you be like, oh, thanks, and then take the stem and crush it between your fingers?
Depends on...
I know, you're the master of... what's the book, Nastasia?
The Grand Nuit flower decorating book.
And Nastasia is a firm believer. If she hates almost everybody. Have you ever been to the restaurant?
Yeah.
Was it good?
A long time ago. Yeah.
But anyway, they're flower decorating at Le Grand Nuit. Is it Le or La Grand Nuit?
La.
La.
Frogs are feminine?
Yes.
Okay. So it's La Grande Nuit. Apparently, they have like one of the greatest. Okay. Say it. Accent.
La Grande Nuit.
Or now say it. Now say it with African French accent.
Oh, jeez.
Do it.
No.
You're the one that made me do it.
Oh my God. You're not bringing me into.
That's where you learned French.
Yeah, I know.
So you're. What? That's not funny. That's not funny. That's true. He learned French initially with an African accent.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then
how does that sound?
Well, you just instead of the "huh," you do a rolled "r" instead.
Yeah, anyway,
Dave's just waiting, expecting.
He's not going to do it. Peter's not going to do it. He does a good accent. Anyway,
yeah.
But the what were we talking about? So flower decorating. That's you actually like
pinnacle.
That.
Yeah,
but it treats every different flower
in a different way. The way it's supposed to be treated when
anyway,
it's cut.
Yes, mm-hmm. Back to Christmas tree farms. Do you remember the first things we did for Booker and Dax? One of the last things we did was Nastasia and I at the French Culinary. Nastasia, I went down and got a Christmas tree, and they're like, "This one looks better." We're like, "Don't care." We're just smelling the Christmas trees to figure out which one we like the smell of. Took it back up to the French Culinary Institute and then completely denuded it of needles. We just took the Christmas tree and just instantly stripped all the needles off of it. And people were like, what are you doing? Shut up. And then we like distilled the entire tree.
Yeah.
We sat there and distilled the entire tree.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome.
Through a rotovap. Mm-hmm. And then we made like 1,500 pine drinks for MTV. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
It was like MTV. And we did all of those pine things. And that's actually where I was using those EC bottles that I made.
I was so angry at that event. I don't remember why.
No, I wasn't. That was the one where I didn't
angry
even.
Angry at an event?
No. That's the event where, remember, all I did was shake. We had
it was
one,
fun.
We had one person who batched. One person who added ice to the ECs. I shook all night long, and another person had poured because we were just there was just boom, 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 and we were carbonating a la minute. Remember that? 1,500 drinks, ridiculous. 1,500 people, God knows how many drinks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Christmas trees, fun.
So our auction went for $2,550.
All right, nice. All right. That is very nice. We're not going to call out who bought it, but we eagerly wait you coming and sitting down at Cooking Issues. Remember, though, when you show up at Cooking Issues, you're going to get dragged into the conversation. It's just the way it works. Yeah. And also,
dragged through the mud.
Well, no. I mean, we're nice to guests, I think, except Peter. and we also like to thank, during the fundraising drive, these people for supporting Heritage Radio Network on behalf of Cooking Issues program. Peter, Grego, Carlos, Zachary, Thomas, Tad, Co. Oh, like him. Remember, he bought us the Modernist Cuisine book. He's down in, where is he, Texas? Texas, I think. Nick and Mark. Anyway, thanks so much, folks, for supporting Cooking Issues and the Heritage Radio Network. Next, we got Matt Cholik writes in from Seattle. Dear Nastasia and Dave, thanks for the show. My question covers cocktails. Acidic things like lime juice, orange juice, and even some sodas tend to really upset my stomach. I'm a big fan of margaritas, though. I mean, who isn't, really? Margaritas are delicious. I mean, as long as you drink alcohol, margaritas are delicious. Do you like margaritas, Peter?
Love margaritas.
Nastasia?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What do you suggest? My question has three parts. What do you suggest I use to bring lime juice's pH up to 7 so I can see what cocktails taste like with lime flavor but without the sour? Baking soda comes to mind, but I suspect that will compromise the drink's flavor. It will, and by the way, you're never going to get it all the way up to 7, I don't think. I'm guessing sour is pretty essential to the drink's taste, but only loosely correlated with the actual acidity, such that there are substances packing equivalent sourness to lime juice that leave a drink's pH closer to neutral. Any thoughts of some options? And finally, do you have any ideas for a solid lemon-lime juice substitution that I could request at a bar? Asking for a margarita shaken with an antacid tablet seems unworkable for multiple reasons. I tried making myself just a Cointreau tequila and simple syrup drink, but it wasn't particularly good. No, I don't imagine that it would be. Remember, if you are going to reduce the acid, you have to also reduce the sugar by a lot. And if you're going to make low-acid drinks in general, this is not answering your question, but which I will answer in a minute. But when you're making a drink that doesn't have any acid in it, like an old fashioned, like typically to add brightness to an old fashioned, and first of all, remember, it has a minimal amount of sugar. So a 2 ounce pour in an old fashioned is not very diluted and has about a quarter of an ounce to 3/8 of an ounce of normal 50% simple syrup in it. To add brightness to that, a twist. And the essential oil from like either a grapefruit or a lemon or an orange or sometimes a lime, although I'm not a huge fan most of the time of lime twists, fresh, bright, inherently citrus note of those oils gives you a sense of freshness, which is part of what acidity brings, is a freshness. So you should always start by, if you're going to reduce the acid, if not eliminate the acid, adding twists to things, because that's going to help punch up the brightness. Also, reducing sugar content substantially is going to allow you to use less acid. Anytime you have a high sugar content, you're going to require more acid to balance it out. So if you were allowed to have minimal amounts of acid, like they're in sodas, like you say, you might want to switch to carbonated margaritas, because carbonated margaritas have less sugar, more water, but less sugar overall, and also less acid, and they're delicious. But what I would not do baking soda because it's going to make it salty and weird. I would actually try – I was going to try it myself, but I don't have any left at the house. Sodium citrate. So sodium citrate is a salt of citric acid, but it acts as a buffer. And I did some basic calculations. So the classic margarita spec that we use – has in it about is about 172 milliliters after it's been shaken and strained, and contains about 1.34 grams of acid as citric. It's actually a mix of citric and malic, and that ends up being a molarity of 0.04% and a titratable acidity of roughly 0.78. Orange juice, on the other hand, has an acidity of 0.8, of titratable acidity of 0.8. Now, I test it. If you go on the online and you look up the pH of something that has a citric acid with a molarity of 0.04, you get a pH of 2.29. However, orange juice, which has a very, very similar titratable acidity, very similar molarity, has a pH of 3.3 to almost up to 4. And the reason the pH is higher is because not all of that citric acid is going to, deprotonate. It's not going to the word's not coming to my mind. It's not going to turn to acid there. It's not going to actually reduce the pH as much. But anyway, so what you're looking at with a margarita is basically the acidity of orange juice. And so I would just test with orange juice because it's a lot cheaper to test orange juice than otherwise. And I would add to your orange juice for every like 172 grams of orange juice, if you add about a gram and a half of sodium citrate, you might increase the sourness, but you're definitely going to also increase the pH. You might be able to knock it up like a whole point, which is a log level, 10 times less acidity. Now, you said that I should recommend a pH meter to you so that you can get one. I don't use them in the bar because I care only about the taste, which is correlated more to titratable acidity and less to pH. But for your case, where you're actually trying to reduce the actual acidity, you get a pH meter. Go ahead and get one. If me telling you to get one helps you get one, get one. The one I use is the X-Tech. pH meter is a little bit of a pain in the butt because you have to change out the sensors, and once the sensors dry out, they kind of lose their efficacy. There are some cheaper ones out there now on Amazon that I don't have any experience with. The X-Tech is not that much more expensive, and I know it works. So anyway, there you go.
Hey, we got a caller on the line.
What about essential oils? All right, never mind.
Essential oil? Well, that's like saying twists. Yeah. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. My name is Marlene. I'm calling from Brooklyn. I actually was at Otto a couple weeks ago, and you made me two great Italiano stallianos, so
nice.
Thanks. But I had a question about food mills, which you were complaining about last week. So for the holidays, my family makes homemade applesauce, and we, like, cook down the apples and then throw them in the food mill, skins on. But it's a pain in the ass because the skins get stuck under that crank.
Right.
So I was wondering if you had any thoughts about other ways to make applesauce.
Well, that's a good question. And so I just did some – this is kind of like related to what you were saying. I just did some experiments with tomato juice and spinning tomato juice to get the paste out of it. And we had this argument with Mark Ladner about food mills and the way he does tomatoes. And it is true that – tomato done through some form of strainer like that is better. The tomato paste was so much better, and the juice was so much better. And I'm sure with applesauce, it's so much better. I don't know of a good – I mean, you could pass it through a Tammy, but that's also a pain in the butt. I would just try passing it through a Tammy. Do you have – you know, you can get a big Tammy for pretty cheap and then just a plastic scraper, and it's got such a larger surface area. I mean, how much applesauce are we talking about?
We make, like, maybe, like, a gallon and a half, so not, like, a ton.
Oh, yeah. Get a big salad bowl and a big Tammy, and then just pass it through with a spatula, because you're basically doing that with a food mill anyway. Like, let's not pretend that a food mill is anything worse than better than an ineffective scraper on a really crappy Tammy that's hard to, like, open up and clean. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
I would go Tammy on that. Now, what I would like to experiment with, but I haven't, is there's a bunch of hand crank tomato strainers that are meant for, like, you know, old grandma sauce, right? Now, I don't know whether they're any good or not. KitchenAid makes a tomato strainer attachment for people that make a lot of tomato sauce. It might also work for applesauce. I don't know. You know, it's designed to let through enough pulp to have, like, a bodied thing, but to exclude the larger things. So it's not going to be as fine a grain as something like a, you know, Champion, which lets very little through, or even like the Breville juicer, which lets slightly more pulp through. But it's a strainer. It's meant to let the, you know, most of the particulate through, but exclude, like, seeds and skins and stuff like that. So I would try also – I would look into whether they're reasonably priced to try. But for a gallon, yeah, and you're not going to – no one's ever said, oh, I wish I didn't have this Tammy when it comes time to also sift flours. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that sounds good.
Yeah. Whereas I've heard everyone be like, I wish I didn't have this freaking food mill because now I feel obliged to use it and it was too expensive to throw away and that's wasteful and I feel like a bad human, right? There's nothing but regrets in food mill land.
They're pretty cheap on Amazon now.
What is food mills?
Yeah.
They're never cheap. Think of your labor. Think of your labor. Value your time. Food mills are garbage.
Suck.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, let us know. Tweet us back or whatever. Let us know how it works.
All right, thanks so much.
All right, thanks. You too. I had a Twitter question in on grinding spices. Someone wants to know, how do I grind small amounts of spices? Because, you know, they use the Whirly Blade spice grinder, like the one that we have, to grind.
And you're going
to
say...
What?
Marijuana thing.
No, I'm actually not, because those are good to carry around in your knife kit if you need to grind something on quickly. That's what I use the marijuana grinder for grinding spice, you know, that you can carry in your knife kit. But at home, mortar and pestle, man. Mortar and pestle is the way to go. I think everyone forgets, like, you know, in this era of high-tech everything, that a mortar and pestle can take down, like, a single clove into a fine powder that you can put into anything that you want. And so it is a pain in the butt to use a mortar and pestle on really large quantities of things because things kind of slide and pop around and stuff like that. But if you can take a small amount of spice and just go, ugh, with the mortar and smash it into a million pieces, right, that's the way to go.
And stop using email.
I wasn't on email. I didn't. Well,
none of that high tech gadgetry. Bring out the mortar and pestle.
You should smash your phone with the mortar and pestle.
Yeah.
You know. Darren writes in about Martini Madness. Hello, it's Darren. The bartenders where I work were recently given a little speech about and a push to win a competition called Martini Madness in the Sonoma Valley. And although I have nothing to do with it, being a line monkey, I have a few questions regarding the subject. The only two rules. My phone just decided not to. Okay. The only two rules are that it's made with an olive and also that it uses Prohibition brand spirits, which is a company based out of the area. Anywho, I thought long and hard on the olive and the drunkenness responsibly and came up with an idea which requires floating the cocktail, even though I am pretty sure that the clientele are not going to appreciate this entirely. I want to make a sun-dried tomato, orange, and lemon water that is thickened ever so slightly above the average density of vodka, around 0.916. That's the density of vodka. That is true. Whereas, you know, water is 1 and sugared water is higher than 1. So it allows vodka, which is infused heavily with manzanilla olive, I like the buttery flavor, to easily float above it, topped with a thyme oil. The thickening also serves as a textural contrast, as this pairing is a favorite pasta sauce from my family, and I thought the idea of pulling a straw up through the cocktail as you drank it would be a fun concept. So my question is, would xanthan gum or a lightly heated gelan low acyl provide a better texture to actually drink while giving the appropriate density to float an infused vodka, or do you have a better solution? And this is not exactly radio talk, but I would happily set up a payment plan to purchase a Spinzol if that is something that could be set up before or after you reach your target goal, be it layaway or otherwise. I can't justify the cost for personal to potential professional use at this time, but either way, you guys are badasses for bringing such an invention to the market. And if it can do what it says, I can't see why any kitchen wouldn't find a use for it. As we say, verbal bravogram, yeah, from your lips to God's ears there. But I don't know. I haven't thought about it. You know, we'll see what happens in the future. If we get it funded and we actually have them in stock, then, you know, we have a lot more leeway. Now back to flexibility, which is not a word Nastassi and I use very often. Flexibility. So
compromise.
What? So let's get back to our question. I wouldn't use xanthan. Xanthan thickened, you could ever so slightly put xanthan in it, but xanthan has a very particular look to it, a feeling to it that I, you know, that's not so pleasant. Like, if you're going to do xanthan, you want to keep it well under 0.25%. A low acyl fluid gel, I think, would be your best bet, but it has to be really, really light. Now, I'll have you know that I happen to have, as I told you before, some tomato water sitting around in my fridge, and I took it out of the fridge and floated some vodka on top of it and just did it on the back of a bar spoon and was able to get a pretty good float. There was some mixing along the line, but just a good old-fashioned Pousse Café technique was enough to float vodka right on top of the tomato water. But if you want to thicken it because you want that textural difference, then I would do low-acyl gelan. Another thing you can do that doesn't jack the sugar appreciably, and you don't want to drink too much of it, you give them the runs, is you could hit it with a non-sweet or a low-sweetness sugared product like isomalt or something like that. But it will increase the sweetness. I've done densified cocktails with that or with low-DE glucose syrup because it adds a boatload of density. And you're not actually thickening it, but you're just increasing the density of it, which is, I think, what you want to look at. If you actually want to thicken it, sure, go fluid gel. But if you just want to increase the density, I would go with something like a low DE, like very almost unsweet, almost no sweetness, glucose syrup or something of that nature. But vodka will float directly on the top of tomato water. And, of course, the oil float on that. You just have to be careful when you pour it, right? That make sense? Yeah? All right. And we're about to get kicked off the air, but lastly, we have nothing else we need to talk about, right? Anthony from Nashville writes in, "Hey, Dave, I just wanted to shoot you a quick thanks for speaking out against sexual harassment in the hospitality industry on the show 2 weeks ago. As a longtime kitchen worker, I've been witness to many acts of casual sexual harassment, sexism, and plain old bullying in the restaurant. Regretfully, I sometimes behave the same way in my ignorant youth, so I know how easy it is to not realize or understand that it's wrong. No one should ever be made to feel uncomfortable like that, especially when they go to work. And I think you deliver that message quite clearly and effectively on the show. I know a lot of bonehead cooks who think that catcalling at the hostess and alcohol addiction are just fun parts of being in the pirate crew. A lot of these same guys, as well as many like them, I'm sure, are frequent listeners of Cooking Issues and hold you in high regard. So I think it's great that you can use this platform to spread a positive message that hopefully will touch some lives. Thanks, and keep up the good work. Anthony from Nashville." And he says, "P.S. I would be super stoked if book two turns out to be The Miracle of Moisture Management," which I doubt it will be, Anthony. I think I know what the next book's going to be about. We could talk about it maybe next week on Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.